Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the Roker Report podcast in association with Sunderland Community Soup Kitchen and Her Game 2, the campaign against sexism and misogyny in football. My name's Rich Spate and I'm joined down the line this evening by a very special guest, a former Sunderland player, writer and editor of a football magazine. We're joined by Jen O'Neill. How are you this evening, Jen?
I'm good, thank you. I'm focusing on what you're asking, but I'm also got another eye on Arsenal in the Women's Champions League.
What's the score? What's the score currently?
It's 1-0 to Arsenal.
1-0 to Arsenal.
They're in Denmark.
Yeah, they are. I saw them all over the social media.
If anybody follows women's football and watched the World Cup in 2019, Nikita Paris took a penalty and had it saved again. Why is she still doing this to herself?
Her avatar on FIFA is, I think, my son's favourite player at the minute because she keeps winning him championships right now. He's quite obsessed with playing with the England women's team at the minute.
But
it's his thing.
As we all know, as Sunderland supporters, it's like just penalties are just... you can't... The whole concept of them is... And as an England fan, I just can't cope with them, so...
I always write a game off if it goes to penalties. We'll get into it. You've had a long association with football, long association with Sunderland Football Club and football in Sunderland. How did you get into playing the game? Because I guess back in the 80s, it wasn't too common for girls to be kicking the ball around.
I would have thought, I'm 46, I don't mind saying that. There were surely people of a similar age knew quite a lot of the lads would have known one or two girls that played football in their town at least, or
but it wasn't all the girls by any means.
Actually, so I grew up in a cul-de-sac in Jarrow, on an estate in Jarrow, and my friends similar age were boys, and so I just started playing football with them, and they were good footballers as well, and that was from the age of about 6 when we moved there until I think even like 18, 19 when I came back from uni, I would have a kick about with them. And that's when I knew that, because they didn't hold back. I remember being lifted in one tackle and it took about sort of 5 seconds to come back down to earth. So I never had any misconceptions about the difference in physicality between men and women, you know, when people go on about, oh, well, why can't you have mixed football? To an extent that might work, but I don't think it would really in reality. But yeah, so I just knocked about with the lads and played with them. Then even at actually primary school, because I played, we had about 4 or 5 different girls would play at break at lunchtime. It was like teacher strike. So I got to play 1 or 2 friendly games against other schools in the school team, and another girl did as well because I'd played all the way through. She'd played and was reasonable. I was good at all sport. I think that's the same story, isn't it? But the easiest thing to practice on your own is football. Take a ball, keep you up, show off at the bus stop, in front of the bus stop when the bus comes, do a few extra tricks and that kind of thing. You can't do that with a netball or a hockey stick. I used to nearly take the neighbour's dog out when she tried to go for the ball when I was practicing playing hockey on the grass outside. So it was always football. And I was and my neighbour, Mark Webber, he was like my best mate. Mm-hmm. He was a Sunderland supporter. So I think him and his dad took me. It must have been about, I don't know, like 10 or 11, something like that. Because I remember for a few years begging for a Sunderland shirt, the Nike one, for Christmas, and they wouldn't get me it. Because I think my mum and dad thought it was like a phase or something. maybe I was a bit younger, actually. And then in about 89, I think it was, there was an advert in the programme. Sunderland in those days, can you remember? They were the caring club.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the
yeah.
community section was a big thing. And it was Mick Ferguson, ex-Leeds player, who was head of the community at the time. I think he must have spoken to a few other sort of football in the community officers around the country, and I think it had been probably spearheaded by Millwall, had taken a team in and actually done quite a lot of developing young players throughout the 80s, a lot of the England team, Hope Hell, mm-hmm. people like that, came through Millwall. So maybe he spoke to Jim Hicks or somebody who's doing something equivalent, and so adverts in the programme turned up and had a bit of a kick about and that kind of thing. And I think because that did attract quite a few people who were enthusiastic, but not that many great footballers, he then... Yeah. managed to find these, well, there was a five-a-side league at the Northumbria Centre in Washington. People should know it. Is it still there?
Yeah, I used to play a five-a-side there myself.
Well, that was on a Wednesday night, and actually there were some really quite decent teams in it. The White Horse from South Shields had a team randomly. But there was these two teams from Easington, and they ended up making the bulk of the Sunderland team, plus a few extras that sort of got dragged in. And I went and played for like one of the Easington teams on a Wednesday night. And they had some good footballers and some real characters. So it was a kind of ramshackle bunch of people brought together. And I think Mick took charge of it for a little while and then played a few sort of friendlies with North East teams. Not that there was many. There was Middlesbrough, was obviously had the heritage from the 70s. Mm-hmm. And Newcastle. And I think probably around the same time Cowgate Kestrels were starting up. I can't quite remember playing them, but they become more important as time goes on because they become our sort of main rivals. Yeah, so, and then in 1990, a team went to France to play in a friendly tournament in Saint-Nazaire, which I guess is the twin town in France of Sunderland.
Yeah, it is.
And
yeah.
I think that was a sort of the start of it becoming a bit more serious and better run. I say serious and better run, it's all relative because it definitely wasn't. But I think I was about 15 or 16, and Sue Smith, who was one of the forwards who played for Sunderland for a long time, I think she was only 14. So, you've got these sort of teenagers who got drunk on the boat, that kind of thing.
Well, that is one thing we'll come to in a bit in terms of like the age at which a lot of players started and the kind of the range of ages involved in women's football, but especially early in the development, I guess, of at least modern women's football in England. But also, I mean, we have the same now. We've got Grace Eade, who's just broken into Mel Rea's side, age 16, signed straight up from the regional talent club. So. It's still there and it does amaze me. But you went off to Oxford, which must have been exciting.
Well, I was just going to say, so that tournament, there's a picture or two because we were presented on the Roker Park pitch. I got my player of the tournament thing from Tony Norman, and there was a picture of the team and the most horrendous array of shell suits you could imagine. But it was 1990, and I think in the women's game got a boost because of the World Cup that year. I think a lot of people, a lot of kids, everybody was like, that was a phenomenal tournament. So it gave the game a boost, and there was a national league started by the WFA, and that suddenly made the women's game way more serious than it had been, and that meant we were playing against good teams. So actually at the age of sort of 17, 18, I was taking it quite seriously. I was fit, and we were playing, you know, as far south as Milton Keynes, and you're playing in cup competitions. And before that, we'd been in the Yorkshire and Humberside League. So all of our, every game apart from home games, it was like 2 or 3 hours. And some of the lasses would have been out on the night before, got drunk, didn't want to play, didn't turn up for the bus. We'd be driving around in the minibus, knocking on people's doors, trying to get people out of bed to come and play. Or I know so-and-so, she'll come and play. So that was the Yorkshire. And then you go into the National Division or in the National League, North and South Division, and that became a bit more serious. Then I went to university. So it did start being more of a better, or at least it needed to be better run in sort of 91-92. And we were a decent standard as well for that time, I guess. And Cowgate Kestrels were in that league as well.
Yeah, and there didn't seem to be too many records around of that time. So it was really interesting to hear about like what was going on and how organised it was. And so how did you do in that national division? Were you competitive?
It was a national league, but it was a North and South division.
All right, okay.
Yeah, so we were sort of middle to below middle. But that we were playing against more established clubs. You know, there were Wolves, teams like that, I think were in the Villa. And some of those teams had been around for quite a while. There's teams that had been established throughout the 80s playing in cup competitions and local sort of regional leagues.
No, it is really interesting to hear about 90s women's football. Wasn't something that I was particularly aware of, but
it was under the auspices of the WFA, so it's a bit like what's happened now with the WSL. It's like women's football didn't exist before 2011. Well, it's a bit like when the FA took over 92, 93. It's like women's football didn't exist at all before that. So the WFA did actually send out newsletters every week, which were quite detailed and gave you quite a lot of information. And so they are knocking around, and I've got some floating about. And so there are some real... well, they're very important people, the anoraks, who've kept this information, because otherwise it would just be totally ignored.
I think it's really important historical documents. And when it comes to Sunderland Football Club, I'm sure the historians around the club, Rob and others, will be really, really interested to see some of that material. Because I spoke to Rob a couple of weeks ago about this matter, and he said that there's a job to be done there. There's a project. There's almost a social history project, really, that is... you know, there to be done in terms of collating and recording and kind of making sure that all of this stuff is kept for the history of the sport, because it's really important, you know, and especially even, you know, the oral history from people like yourself who were there, who were on the minibuses knocking up their mates to come and play Yorkshire and Humberside League games. That's where the game came from, and it's really important stuff.
So we used to train at the Charlie Hurley Centre, but I think then they decided that they probably didn't want us there, so they shifted us to Moor Lane between Cleveland and Whitburn. It's where the academy or the Academy of Light is now, but they just had a couple of fields there. It was actually quite a decent surface, but that was a sort of subsidiary training ground that Sunderland had.
Was that where the youth team played on a Saturday morning?
Yeah, it probably was, yeah.
Yeah, but it didn't have perimeter anything.
It was just a bit of grass.
Yeah, it was turn up and stand around the edge of the pitch stuff. Yeah. But you were supported by Sunderland Football Club, and I think that's an important thing to get down, that, you know, the club has instigate the team.
Yeah, and they were one of the first professional clubs to do that, I think. So that's worth acknowledging. The problem is that then it was a bit checkered after that, because certainly in 2000s and whatever, and when money came into the game more, and they didn't have it, or priorities changed. But we wore the men's kit, but the sort of hand-me-down men's kit. So I'm sure one game it used to have to, because it was massive. But the problem was, if you got John McPhail's shorts, because you know how he used to like rip them up the side?
Oh, yeah.
Because he obviously had big thighs, and if he was going to leg it up the pitch to have a fight, you need to be able to stride, didn't he? So they were already huge, these Hummel shorts, and then like, I've got John McPhail's shorts again. Like, you'd be like floating, like you'd be like having some kind of umbrella or a balloon attached to you.
Well, you did get a place at Oxford University.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? Comprehensive kid from Jarrow. South Tyneside College.
That's an achievement in itself. Back then, it can't have been too many lasses from Jarrow, from the northeast, who went down. Or were there a few of you?
Yeah. I mean, from a technical college, from South Tyneside College. I think it was the second year they did A-levels as well. There weren't any people who did that. And that's actually a problem, because I felt like a fish out of water. But football was my saviour in a way, because although I made friends in my college who studied this were reading geography like me. When people say, what did you read? I always say beer and football, because that was more the truth. although I made good friends at college, I also met people from the Oxford University women's football team who had similar backgrounds to me and were actually decent players. One of them, Kirsty Hewitson, played in a cup final for Southampton and played Arsenal reserves for a while and played for Wembley in a Premier League cup final and stuff. So yeah, I was a fish out of water. I sort of lived up to the stereotype of being a northeast girl.
But it's good that you had football there to kind of like as a solace and as a way of just like connecting with people, because I've heard many stories of people who've been to Oxford Bridge Unis from kind of our kind of backgrounds, comprehensive school kids from the Northeast, who have really, you know, struggled to make those social connections. And that's the great thing about football as well. It's a leveller, I guess.
Yeah.
In many ways.
Yeah, and you meet people from, certainly it's like at Oxford, they have like Rhodes or various types of scholars. So you meet these Americans that come over and then you're, what? You're from Stanford? All right, I've heard of them. You know, like they were like big soccer mm-hmm. colleges and good players would come along. We played in the local leagues and around Oxford in the southern region, but they hated us because we couldn't play certain times of the year because we weren't in college. So that was quite interesting, learning the politics of regional leagues when I went to meetings and stuff.
So you did your 3 years, you did your degree?
And every time I came home, I was Granville Mervyn was the manager at that time. So originally he was a guy called Ray Houghton, I think, who was a taxi driver, probably from Easington. He used to like smoke all the time out the window, but he's such a genuine guy. He had a sheepskin coat, so he was obviously a manager. He was in charge. And then Granville Mervyn came in, who was an A licence coach and worked, I think, with some of the Sunderland kids teams. And he always said that when Jen comes back from university, she's a shoe-in into the first team. So I sort of still played when I was at home, but it wasn't at the same level as the National League that we'd been in previously had been.
Right, so we were, the club was moving kind of between national and regional leagues, given...
Well, it sort of dropped out of that and then it didn't have the same calibre of players, although there were some sort of good young players coming through.
Yeah, so around about, I guess, the same time you finished uni, did you get involved in journalism then and writing about football? And I think you mentioned in the lead-up to our chat that you were making programmes. Is that something you were involved in?
Well, no, that was just, I was the media officer for the team, like for Blyth and then for Sunderland, which we'll sort of explain. I would add, though, that all through the 90s when I was, even especially while I was at university, is more impressive. My dad would drive the Sunderland team in the minibus to every game, all over the Yorkshire and God knows wherever. And he did that without fail. And he was the secretary of the team. And then he helped set up the Northern League and the Northern Combination through the FA. What a nice bloke. The bloke who wouldn't buy me any football boots or a Sunderland top when I was a kid because it was a phase, but he's a guy who believed that every... I was talking about him in the past tense. He's still with us. He believed that everybody should have the opportunity to play football if they want to. And so I think that's massive. But I'm a bit like him. That it's not... It'll never be about him.
Yeah. There's so many parents like that as well. You know, I think we spoke to Beth Mead's dad a few weeks ago on our last podcast live, just finding out, you know, all about how he'd supported her career. And I know she talks really highly about how they pushed her to the next level every time, you know, to move from kind of Whitby to Middlesbrough to Sunderland to Arsenal and keep moving forward in her career. And we also, you know, we know that a lot of our Lasses Podcast Live listeners are the mums, the sisters, the dads of the current team. And I think, you know, that's still there in the game, isn't it? That the parents of you know, young female footballers are really important to the development of the game overall and the maintenance of the game.
Yeah, but I wasn't even there. That's the sort of, like a lot of it. And even when I got back, I had sort of half had ideas about an American girl was supposed to go and play in Sweden, but she got a contract in the Pro League at the time in Japan. So she got in touch and said, I've told them about you. Do you want to go to Sweden? So I sort of got training a bit and then dislocated my elbow, which seemed I'd already done once at university. Became a bit of a long-term problem for me. I got a phone call from Granville, who then moved to Blyth, and he said, will you come along and just train with us to get fit to start with? And round about the same time, I got a call from somebody who'd set up a women's football magazine based in Gateshead, Andy Mullen. His stock line is that Newcastle sold Andy Cole, and his daughter was really upset, and he was a publisher looking to find a sort of niche area to start up a magazine. And so he thought, oh, well, hang on a minute, there's something in this. That's where the kernel of the idea came from. And that was in 1996. And I joined in, I graduated in 1996, did various sort of bits and bobs, and then joined On the Ball, as it was called, in 1998, in April. My first job was to go down to London and interview Hope Howell in her flat, because she'd just been given the England job, or, well, got the England job.
That's a great assignment. You know, that's...
Yeah, she liked me then. She made me a cup of tea. She gave me an Italy boot bag. She must have got playing in an international game against them. We had a good chat.
You know, it must have kind of raised your, you know, ambitions in terms of what's possible in the media. And you can go and speak to, you know, the main people in the game. And you
no, well, make... nobody else was interested. That's the problem to a large extent. I didn't have any necessarily like ambitions to become a journalist, although all my friends would say, oh, you should get into writing, because I would normally be sending them silly emails or sort of maybe good with words. And I'd done my work experience when I was 16 at the Shields Gazette. So that was exciting, wasn't it? That was always kind of, I suppose, on the cards, but I wasn't that keen on the competition to get into that area. And I wasn't that keen actually to join On the Ball when I was first asked. I had to have a think about it. And then what I did decide was, why I felt embarrassed to be a female footballer. So I then thought, well, this is wrong. Nobody should feel like this. I'm going to try and make sure that other people don't feel like that by being the place where that information is shared, and make role models and do all of those things. And it started a career of just basically doing anything you're asked or coming up with things that you can do to help the game. It's been pretty crazy, to be honest.
No, it's a really important role, though, in promoting the game, promoting the people who play it, and like you say, the people who kind of make it happen behind the scenes as well. And you mentioned that you went up to Blyth. Were Blyth part of the Kestrels at that point? Because
this is women's football.
Kestrels moved around. They were Cowgate, and then they were Newcastle, and then they were Blyth.
Well, they were Cowgate initially, and sort of a lot of their players came from Blakelaw, mm-hmm. Cowgate, and they were like a five-a-side team. I think they started out as well. And then they, I don't know the order. They were RTM Kestrels. They were like Newcastle Blue Star. They were with, and then Blyth must have invited them in, and I was only there maybe 2 years while it was at Blyth, and it was fantastic there. It was so good, like the Blyth Spartans fans support. Like we're not talking huge numbers, but they respected and supported the women's team because it was Blyth, because it was their club. That was happening elsewhere in the country, but I hadn't really seen it to that extent before. Do you know, like you're in the car park or something, arriving and somebody's leaving the bar, or you're the centre back, aren't you? You're this number six or whatever. They recognised who you were just in the car park. They're like, well, yeah, that was a nice thing.
Was that the position you were playing then? You were in the back four for Blyth.
Yeah. By then, I had been a midfielder at university, and but also would play left back, sort of left wing back when I was fitter or in other teams. I played British universities, so representative, and that's how On the Ball heard about me.
All right.
And because they asked the manager of that, do you know somebody who's graduated recently from the Northeast who would be good to come on board to work with us on this magazine?
So you had 2 years with the Kestrels in Blyth. And what standard was that? What league structure were you playing in?
Well, that was the... That was the Premier League in the Northern Division.
All right.
One of the good things about the WSL is that it doesn't have a huge long-winded name. So it was the, at that time, I think AXA were sponsors even then. So it was the AXA Women's Premier League Northern Division or Southern Division or National Division. So there was the top tier, and then there was the two regional leagues below that. And Blyth were in the Northern.
Sunderland have obviously just come out of the FA Women's National League Premier Division, which is the third tier.
So that's
it?
The old Premier League, because they fought to keep it going. Yeah.
So that's the same structure retained, a bit like kind of in the men's game where the Football League remained after the Premier League was created. So yeah, there you go. I'm learning loads tonight. So 2 years there playing at that level, and then you ended up back with Sunderland. And that story, I think, is one that I think a lot of people are intrigued by, how Kestrels at Blyth became Sunderland women.
Well, I'm not going to say that this will stand up in a court of law, because I need to double check a few things. But how I remember it or interpret it, and I think some people on the Wounded Party side suggest that I was a main instigator in this, but I really wasn't. I wasn't. But we were Blyth, and it became apparent that East Durham and Hoffel College, which are they still called that, based at Peter Lee, but they also have the campus at Hoffel, they wanted to take us in, and they had money to sort of, nobody was getting paid, but we were buying umpteen raffle tickets every week and trying to raise money and paying subs and stuff to play for Blyth. We were travelling all over the country. We played a Premier League Cup game against Southampton. And we always drew Arsenal in the League Cup. I mean, you didn't even need to look at the draw. You knew you were going to get Arsenal, and you knew it was going to be away, and you knew it was going to be painful. And that carried on a bit, actually, into the 2000s. But so East Durham were waving cash at us, and that's when Mick Mulhern was brought on board, and his assistant, Alan Snowden, who was with Gateshead College, which has been important in the genesis of Sunderland women's team as well. Mm-hmm. So many players, and obviously Mel's coach there. He came on board, and we became East Durham Kestrels, and we played in white and purple, and we played at Peter Lee, and we won the league. I mean, in every season I played for a version of Sunderland, we either won the Northern Division or finished runners-up in it, or were in the top flight. And if we didn't win anything, I was probably injured. I did spend a couple of years where I had a sort of injury-ravaged time. But yeah, so we went to East Durham. We won the league, and I was trying to get sponsors and all this kind of stuff and putting together packages and thinking, oh, well, maybe they'll sponsor us. And in the midst of all of this, I don't know who made the initial contact, but Bob Oates was the community director football in the community, the new version of it at Sunderland at that time. And obviously Sunderland were kind of doing quite well, mm-hmm. sort of around 2000. So they said, well, why don't you, because we've just got promoted into the national division, this is the big time, why don't you come and join us and we'll look after you and we'll give you all the stuff that you need. The problem was they already had a Sunderland ladies team, which was playing a bit lower down the pyramid, but that's not really our problem, which is a really sort of callous thing to say. And various meetings and threats of, you know, legal action and stuff and votes and protracted nonsense, we ended up moving to and going under the auspices of Sunderland and merging with that Sunderland ladies team. But the problem being that only a couple of them then were sort of good enough to stay around the first team, and sadly some of those sort of frittered away. So that was in that summer. So the first season in the National Division, yeah. which is the equivalent of the WSL now, we were Sunderland wearing the night kit and we got tracksuits and everything.
So you were getting a good amount of support. And with you from Kestrels, if I'm not wrong, came Mel Ray. Was she in the side with you? And
Yeah. She was top scorer in the league for Blyth two seasons in a row. We had a player called Aaron Embleton who made it into the England team. She was like a little mazy little dribbler. And she moved to Doncaster Bells, I think, the year that we got promoted. We'd finished runners-up. Then she got poached and she went to Doncaster. And everybody thought, haven't the Kestrels done really well because they've lost their best player? But she wasn't really our best player. We had a load of other good players, and Mel was one of them. It was her and Donna Lanigan were the big goal. I say big goal scorers. Donna's only tiny from Jarrah as well. But yeah, Mel was a young winger
and a potent goal threat. Because I mean, if you look at the stats from
you mean greedy.
Well, you can.
And she would generally always take the free kicks as well, and she was good at that, and she would take the corners and the free kicks, and so that she would score from that as well.
Loads of opportunities then. to get on the score sheet, Chad. So obviously at Sunderland, National Division, first season, relegation, am I right?
No, we stayed up the first year. Is where it gets interesting because, well, it doesn't, it's not interesting.
No, it is interesting.
It kind of is to me, but the ramifications of it are the important thing. Because we'd been with East Durham College, they had the first National Women's Football Academy based at Hoffel. It was Jill Coulthard, the ex-England captain, Ted Copeland, the ex-England women's manager in the 90s. They were heading that up. And it was residential as well. So some of the best players of that age, sort of 16 to 18, from around, some even from, couple from Scotland. So players from around the country all came to Durham. Who did they play for? Well, they played for Sunderland. And it made us even better than we were before. And we stayed up that first year. We were quite decent. But then what do you do when you go to somewhere like Durham to study for a BTEC or NVQ or whatever? You go, oh, I'm going to go to America on a scholarship. So about 7 or 8 of our team or our squad all jetted off to America. And then I think maybe I had a few injuries or a couple of people in the first team squad get injured. And all of a sudden, you just totally depleted and we had to bring in some of the younger players. That was a hard season. The second season, mm-hmm. That's when we got relegated. And that was quite a blow to Mick, who'd been working with a sort of promising team, a core of loyal, local, good players. And then these talented younger players as well. And then they all left. And he thought, well, I'm going to have to find my own. And I'm going to have to find them quickly and I'm going to have to bring them through. And he started scouting everywhere. He'd already worked at Bolden Girls a bit. So he knew some of the sort of decent kids in the area. But he got more involved in the Centre of Excellence and he got more involved in scouting. And that's when he started to find the real gems that are still playing for England now.
Yeah, I mean, there were some real gems. And when you look at the ages at which they were playing women's football, it's quite astounding. We have got, like, Jill Scott was playing at 13, 14.
They all played at 14. That was the lower limit.
And you had Steph Houghton, the same.
14, yeah.
And
yeah.
Carly Telford.
A goalkeeper at 14 in the... I mean, Rachel Brown-Finnis, though, played in the 96 Cup final when she was 15.
Astounding, really, but... They must have, and you were, you know, you were in your 20s, you're a strong woman playing against young girls. And it must have been a great education for them. And you must have had a decent amount of influence on, like, how they developed as footballers. Because there's always a mentoring element when it comes to young players and older players, isn't there?
I don't know that they, maybe to an extent. I think there's possibly more dominant characters in the team that they not necessarily footballing wise but just personality wise mm-hmm. But on the field I was the, if I got dirty I'd had a bad game because I was just the organizer basically. Occasionally you get you do something that looks a bit swish at the back and everybody has a heart attack. don't do a Cruyff turn on the edge of the box, whatever. But I remember training when Steph, because she was a center forward, mm-hmm. I remember in training and she was elbowing me and then looking to get away in like some kind of defending setup that we had. I thought, oh, this is interesting. This is actually fun now because there's some level of sort of competition. But I also, for quite a few years, would go from one game to the next injured. I'm not saying I was Paul McGrath level, but... It was frustrating for me to sort of be carrying injuries and then be expected to keep on playing. So I didn't train as much as I would have liked to with some of these kids. Jill Scott never beat me on a one-on-one drill thing. Yeah. I'll just put that out there. She won't remember. And like, this is awful, though. Carly Telford's debut was the game we got relegated from the National Division the first time. Yeah, against Brighton. It's a long way to go, isn't it? There's probably about 6 of us in a travel lodge room. You know, it was just, it wasn't posh or anything. And then they got a free kick. She saved it, but she parried it when we all just expected her to keep a hold of it. And flat-footed, I guess. But you just think that's the keepers. And she spilled it and the forward nipped through and scored. And we lost 1-0. And that effectively relegated us. And she was obviously devastated and sort of cried for about 8 hours home. That's how I remember it.
But she come through it.
There's quite a baptism. Yeah, she's done all right, hasn't she?
She's come through it. She's done all right.
She's such a good person. There's absolutely no way that she was to blame for us getting relegated that year. There were much bigger issues than that.
But, you know, these young gems that Mick found, like, scored and played and did fantastic and obviously still had Mel there, still had yourself there and others. And for a couple of years came really, really, really close to regaining that position back in the top flight. I've been looking through some of the articles and reviews that you wrote in the men's programme at the time, which I recall reading on a half-time at the Stadium of Light as my half-time reading. Always, you know, really intriguing. I've got some brilliant profiles amongst those as well. With some quite embarrassing answers, I think, for some of the for some players who are now very senior pros or the manager of the football club. So it must have been a fun time. You know, you were really successful, winning lots of games, came really, really close a couple of times, and then were up.
Yeah, went back up again. End of 2004, 2005. That was the first sort of year of Mick brought these wonder kids in and sort of mixed in with the older lackeys like us. Rachel Furness as well is important to mention. Mm-hmm. That year, Steph played a lot of games. Jill in and out, Carly in goal, and Rachel Furness was brilliant as well. It was an absolute pleasure that season. I think it was a pleasure, although I was annoyed with myself. I think it was similar again, sort of injuries and things and dislocating elbows, and that might have been the season before. We lost to Blackburn twice that year and I didn't play in either of those games and I was fuming because they were my nemesis.
Well, they have been Sunderland's nemesis over the last few years, although we've got the better of them twice this season.
Good. They got a free kick for Carly holding the ball for more than 6 seconds, which is just
doesn't happen, does it?
That's just bullshit. And they scored from it, and won that. And the way they went on really annoyed me. And that was a long time ago.
It's not like you've held a grudge or anything about that. That incident, not one little bit. So how long did you then go on and play for Sunderland Women?
No, well, that was my last game. We drew at Stockport and won the league. They were sort of one of the main rivals. I remember that they played at Cheadle Town and there would be like aircraft flying over the ground. I think Fernie scored a thunderbolt. I pulled my calf, I think. Jill was ill, so she was crying because she couldn't play. But it was good. It was good celebrations, and that was a good season. But then it was the Euros in 2005 in England, and I was working co-coms for Eurosport. So I missed pre-season and was kind of, confidence was a bit rocky. And then somebody who was in the England camp, not one of the players, a friend of mine told me that Hope Hull and everybody had been slagging me off and whatever for my co-coms, because we weren't allowed to say that people weren't brilliant even when things weren't going great in those days. So that kind of hit me a bit, and I just kind of didn't fancy going back for a bit. And Alan and Mick kept saying, "You'll be back, you'll be back." But I didn't ever, I guess, sort of burnt myself out a bit. I was doing columns for the Times and also like on the coach on the way back from games. So we would have played a game, and then I might have had a new bumhole ripped by Arsenal or something, and then I'd have to write a report about this goals in the Times, and I'd have to phone round all of the other National Division teams or whatever and get the scores and who scored and send it off. But you would have a dial-up mobile connection thing in those days. I was just doing it 24/7. It was kind of hard work, is my excuse. I still regret stopping in 2005, though.
How old were you when you stopped?
I was 30.
So you still think you might have had a season or two if you could have got yourself fit?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Well, I was helped sort of coach local teams and stuff, and that was good fun. When you've played from 15 or something and you've given all of your weekends to it forever, and it's a huge amount of travelling that you've done. it does take its toll in a sense.
Yeah, I bet. And a lot of players do struggle with that last bit, almost kind of coming to terms with it and moving into coaching, moving into media. You'd already had that background, you know, in media right from kind of from a few years before, obviously with being in involved in On the Ball. And that did that then just kind of become what you did? It was how you stayed connected with the game?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, absolutely. Because there wasn't really anybody doing it then. So when a journalist wrote an article about women's football or a radio programme wanted to talk about women's football, then like I was rent a gob. So they'd come and ask me, and I'd spend time chatting to them and explaining stuff or going on air and embarrassing myself on the Gloria Honeyford programme to be asked about Ladettes or something like that. Absolutely horrendous. Do you know, but I used to... It's an interesting way of charting how the game's changed, because in the early days, I would be asked on the radio programmes to... and be asked, why do girls and women want to play football? Should girls and women be allowed to play football? That was a genuine debate. And it's still a problem now because the BBC have to balance everything. So you end up having these discussions with Ray Wilkins. That was one. He didn't want to watch women's football or didn't think that women should play football. He obviously needed the money because he helped at Chelsea with the women's team. They would just roll people out to come out with nonsense.
Yeah.
That was frustrating. So, and then that it kind of morphed to why don't the women get paid to play? Why don't the media give women's football more coverage? Which the answer to that is plainly, well, don't be using this time to ask me that question. Just talk about the sport itself. Yeah. Give it some coverage. And look where we are now. It's insane. It blows my mind.
And yeah, I mean, it's come a really long way. There's still a good way to go. I mean, we struggle a little bit in terms of fan media. I think not wishing to blow our own trumpet too much, but you know, there's kind of one Sunderland fanzine that gives us any time, or very much time at all. And amongst a lot of football clubs, there's not too much fan media around it, around women's football. And I think in some ways that's reflected in kind of the patchy support. And I think this kind of is a theme that goes across Sunderland's history of having some brilliant high points and successes and periods at which we were right at the top of the game, with periods where we brought through some phenomenal talent that's gone on to be, you know, some of the top players in world football, both kind of in the past and currently. But then it gets abandoned. And it's the first thing that's abandoned. And one question I want to ask you, as somebody who's got like a long perspective on this and a professional interest in it and knows a lot kind of about the game overall, it's almost the difference, I guess, between a Durham, which is an independent club focused on the women's game, and a Sunderland, where it's kind of, we have to fight to get it recognised. We've had to lobby and campaign to make sure that it's on every agenda at the club. And then you're kind of your global super brands who see it as part of their corporate strategy to have a women's section, possibly because it is good for their brand rather than necessarily the love of it. And it's where you see that mix, because in the women's championship at the minute, we've got a mix of your Durhams and a Lewis, who are unique, and like clubs like Sunderland and Watford. And that's,
well, I was going to say, and London City Lionesses are similar as well as the Durham.
Yeah, who broke away. You know, they almost unilaterally decided to walk away from Millwall.
Well, Millwall weren't happy about that, so that's a difference.
But
it wasn't unilaterally, it was kind of stolen from them, would be the argument.
Oh, well, I mean, I probably don't know quite enough about that situation, but it's that mix of different kind of models. You've got some that are part-time in our league, in the Championship. You've got some that are fully full-time, including clubs like Coventry United, who are tiny in their men's side, and their women's side are really fully pro. And you've got Lewis, who are...
It's not going well for them, is it?
No, and Lewis as well have had a really patchy time. Then you've got clubs like Sunderland and Watford, where it's They've come up at the same time. We're playing each other on Sunday and have got a similar kind of relationship with the men's team. And it's where you see that mix and where it might develop, really, is what I'm interested in your perspective on.
I think it's the question is always like the goal is sustainability. And it's also there's a general manager of a WSL team said this to me recently, and we all kind of acknowledge it as well. It's the balance between what you want to spend on the women's team and what you can, what it justifies spending on, you know, in terms of its the revenue it brings in. So there's always a balance between that, which your average fan of a club can kind of get upset about, and you can kind of understand because it has become all about balancing the books. But I think what I would love is, and it's probably the last chance they'll get, they might disagree, but I'd love it if Durham got promoted, yeah. Because it would, in my opinion, it would absolutely put the cat amongst the pigeons for the FA, because I don't think this is what their vision entails. It's not that sort of, that isn't going to look sexy on Sky. You know, for your average sort of fan, when you're trying to sell it, it is about the big brands. That is what the Premier League are. Am I allowed to say this on the record? Well, I think we all expect at some point the Premier League is going to take over.
I think it's been well trailed. Could come in. I don't think it. This won't be the first pod that's been mentioned as an aside on. I mean, I have a little bit of a almost a conspiracy theory, but it's a little bit based in historical practice. It's a bit maybe a bit of the fear of a Sunderland fan, I guess, that Durham are a really juicy little morsel that a big northeast club who might be looking to jump up the pyramid really quickly could swallow up quite easily, in the same way that, say, Durham Wasps ice hockey team were, Sunderland Scorpions basketball team were, Gosforth rugby team were swallowed up by Newcastle United in the 1990s, that with the noisy neighbours up the road just having been taken over, that there's a risk that Durham may be on their horizon. Do you think I'm barking up the wrong tree, or is there a genuine possibility that could happen?
Well, one of the best ways to sports wash quite quickly with the reputation that you have as a nation state would be to have a women's team. So that seems the most likely way to do it. Although I would be surprised if Lee Sanders would give up everything that he's built. But at the same time, it's hard work, isn't it? I love that they've managed to have the funding to be competitive, to be ready if they do get promoted to compete. That's Durham. But I'm also proud. I'm more excited about this Sunderland team. I was excited about the previous WSL version of the Sunderland team. I mean, one of the best games I've ever been to in my life, and I've had a season ticket for Sunderland men for 30-odd years. Not this year. Terrible, isn't it? Was when Sunderland beat Chelsea 4-0 and Emma Hayes kicked a water bottle into the crowd and Beth Mead scored a hat-trick and she'd rolled a car a couple of days before. I absolutely loved that game. It was that I've got goosebumps thinking of it. It makes me happy. So I loved that side. But this makes me feel like the club cares about the women's team, and the fact that Mel's stuck with it and that Keyes is stuck with it and Abby's come back, and there's a sort of passion to make it work, and there's some really good young players coming through. So that really excites me, and I sort of feel proud of them of having done that. And Watford are sort of similar. What I find frustrating is, why the hell didn't those clubs at that time have the people who are running them now, when they both dropped out of the league in, 2018? They've made it so much more difficult they were in such a good position.
Yeah.
But the women's football is so bloody frustrating.
It is. And what it needs...
For the wrong reasons.
What it kind of needs, I think, and, you know, the sporting director at Sunderland, Christian Speakman, is clear about this. You know, he answered a question at a dinner that I wrote a few weeks ago when he was speaking about this. They're going to keep supporting them. There's a 3 to 5 year plan that they're going to put in place alongside the men's team. They're giving them all of the data and analytics, all of, you know, the training time. Obviously, there's still part-time, so it's on an evening. But there's going to be, hopefully, be a pathway there to professionalism for the squad. I wanted to get your view on like, on that and on, for a club like a Sunderland or a Watford, where you've got, obviously, ambitions in both teams to be Premier League teams in the men's side and WSL teams in the women's side. And, like, what they might need to do in terms of investment to become a professional outfit or you know, almost professional outfit and to make it, because it would be great if Durham could go up and really shake it up. But what we want to see in 2 or 3 years' time is Sunderland really battling right at the top of the league. And it's what that pathway might be and if you've got any insights into where they might go.
Well, I think we've talked about it already, a used sort of mixed example, and that's what Mel's doing. You've got to build your own basis there, and the sort of the loyalty. But there's a benefit to, there was always a drawback to being geographically sort of isolated to an extent. But there's a benefit to it as well, because there's a pride and also wanting to stay in the area, and the hinterland is big for finding talent, and that's being done, and the regional talent club and all of that's in place. And then I suppose I hesitate to say that, because spending more money isn't going to bring success, because they should have allowed that Sunderland team that didn't fit their full-time sort of ideas, the FA, they should have allowed them to carry on battling away with what they had. They should have, if they weren't good enough, they would have been relegated anyway. They didn't need to be demoted. That you need a sporting outcome.
Mm-hmm.
But they've proven time and time again that it's about resources and finances, most importantly. And then the sort of distribution of the talent follows that. So you just need to have that good local base. And then you have a reputation that you can then bring in new players, but there's so much competition to do that.
Yeah.
I don't know how...
You're seeing the WSL, at least...
I didn't answer your question.
No, but I mean, it's interesting you're talking about resources and bringing players in. There's clubs, obviously, in the WSL who are spending, you know, six-figure plus sums on footballers to bring them in. And when that starts happening on a really regular basis, that's going to really increase the, I guess, the gap, do you think?
Yeah, it will do. I think to reinforce the point of you need to build more than buy in, is if you actually look at Coventry, if you look at London City, they are full-time and they have brought players in. But as soon as something goes wrong or that there's no, with the greatest respect, I hope they don't listen to this, but they don't have the cohesion and the passion that a Sunderland or a Durham has. And that isn't just geographical. That's because you're with your mates. There has to be an element of we've come through this together to an extent, because there will always be new talent and people come in. And Grace McCatty isn't from up here and she's been brilliant all season and is a really just a top person. But and Watford to an extent has that core as well. So that will, if they can cryogenically sort of freeze Helen Ward at night so that she sort of stays 35 and carries on scoring, then that they will benefit from that. There's a big history to women's football in Watford, less than in Sunderland, but almost on a par with. And so that matters. Well, it certainly matters to me. And I would hope that it mattered to players. And that can count for a lot.
I think you're absolutely right. And obviously there is this new cohort of youngsters coming through at Sunderland. You've got Niamh Herron, you've got Jess Brown, you've got, you know, Holly Manders and all these girls who are of a similar age and look like really, really good mates.
And I think that their recognition in England squads is partly, well, it's obviously because they've got the ability and the potential, but it's also partly because of the reputation that the Centre of Excellence and the regional talent club has. So they are getting players selected, whereas some clubs quite often get overlooked. And obviously because of the input that Sunderland have had into the England women's team, that matters. Mm-hmm. And so when it's good when you have kids in England squads, because they meet other players who might come and sign for the club in the future, and they hear good things about it. They go, oh, Sunderland are good. I might go and play for them. It's just about maintaining, because it won't just be about cold hard cash, will it? It'll be about wanting to go to a club. And if you only hear good things about them and think good things about them, then that can be an attraction.
Well, I think that's a really nice way to end this conversation, because it's hopeful and it's optimistic. And Sunderland have got Watford on Sunday. It's at 3:30 on the FA Player. Will you be watching, or have you got a media engagement at that time elsewhere?
I'm like a media whore. I'm working for MUTV,
oh, yeah,
doing the Everton-Man U game from Old Trafford.
Wow.
Bizarre, I know. And then skedaddling over to Man City-Chelsea.
Wow.
God knows what's going to happen. So it means I can't go to see Sunderland again.
Well, I'll be watching Durham at midday with my dad, who's a half-and-half scarf guy when it comes to...
To women.
He doesn't have a half and half.
For women, that's right.
He doesn't have a half and half scarf for women's football. He does have a Durham scarf, and I am ribbing him about it, and he will be listening to this and text me about it. And we're going to do a watch-along party on Twitter Spaces for the Sunderland game at 3:30. So there's going to be me and Katie and Ant for half of it. I think he's got work. And Graham probably as well. It's going to be four of us talking about what we're seeing on the screen, trying to distract ourselves from the FA Player commentary, and hopefully people will be able to listen along on their phone and maybe mute the FA Player and follow Sunderland with some fans. And then I think I'm going to have to drive back down to Wales. So it's going to be a fun weekend for me, but it's going to be a fun weekend for everyone. It's Women's Football Weekend. All of our listeners, we encourage, if you can't get to Watford, I think they play in a little village just outside London, and watch on the FA Player. It's all live. It's free. All you have to do is register, and you can watch the lasses play.
With the sound off.
With the sound off. You can listen to us on Twitter. And we're going to have loads of coverage on the website over the weekend. We've kind of taken over. So I want to say thank you very much, Jen, for your time this evening. You've been very generous with it. So, yeah, cheers for that.
No problem. It was a pleasure. Sorry for waffling on.
Oh, no problem at all. We love a good bit of waffle on Rogue Report. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. And, yeah, have a good Women's Football Weekend, and we'll speak to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.